I'm going to mute everybody during the presentation. If you have a question, you can either unmute yourself, wait for the end, or use the chat function. The new version of Zoom doesn't allow me to unmute everybody. I can mute you all, but I can't unmute. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Hannah London, who's going to introduce Seth, and then we'll begin. We currently have 23 people online. There should be 30, so another 7 should sort of wander in over time.
Okay, so as some of you know, I'm one of the co-chairs of the program committee for AJA 50+, but it's not in that capacity that I'm having the privilege of introducing Seth today. Seth is my cousin who is speaking to us today via Zoom, obviously, from Yardley, Pennsylvania. A little couple of notes from his bio. Seth was raised in a secular Jewish home. He attended public schools and Orthodox cheder. During the late 60s, like so many of us, Seth was very interested in avant-garde trends in the arts and music and how visionary artists brought about change and transformation in the arts and in society. After he met Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement, Seth will be talking to us today about his 23 years spent working with Reb Zalman and also his current work furthering Reb Zalman's legacy. So, Seth.
Thank you, Hannah. And I just want to mention, it turns out that a week from Friday night is Reb Zalman's 6th Yahrzeit. And so there's a lot of Reb Zalman events that will be happening. As a matter of fact, next Tuesday night, the Open Shul in Montreal is going to be doing a Reb Zalman event. And Rabbi Cheryl Gilbert, I don't know if people might know her, sent me an email this morning. She said that she's not able to attend. But if you're doing any other Canadian renewal-related events, please let her know in advance, and she'll spread the word. She is the person who puts out the stuff for the Canadian Aleph Alliance for Jewish Renewal. So I guess we didn't include this in her. She wasn't aware of this until I sent her an email last night. So if you do anything in the future related to Jewish renewal, let Cheryl know, and then she'll publicize it. Just wanted to let you know that. And so let's just start off with a little niggun. Reb Zalman used to sing this niggun on Shabbos mornings. He didn't compose this niggun, although he was a very prolific composer. He called it Devorah's niggun because his sister Devorah, who lived in Jerusalem, taught it to him. So we'll just sing a little bit of Devorah's niggun, which is, as far as I know, it's actually a popular Israeli nigun. It goes like this. Yai dai da 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 Yai, die, da, 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 die, die, da, 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 die, 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 die. So, thank you. So I put together a PowerPoint presentation, which was Hannah's suggestion. So I'm going to share that, and I'm going to mostly be talking from my presentation. So let me just quickly share my screen here. And if anyone does have a question or wants to make a comment, please feel free to unmute yourself at any point along the way so we can make it interactive. So what I decided to talk today is about Reb Zalman and me. And I just want to mention that I never took a picture together with Reb Zalman, although I spent a lot of time with him. From the time that I met him, I had the idea that his time was very valuable, and I only bothered him when I felt it was absolutely essential. And taking a picture together with him was something that I never prioritized. So I don't have a picture of me and Reb Zalman. I don't know how many people here know Reb Zalman, know who he is, had any contact with him. So I thought it would be a good idea just to start off to try to give an overview of who Reb Zalman was. So I really struggled to try to adequately portray him and his contribution in a quick time, because I want mostly to focus on my interactions with Reb Zalman, but certainly if we were just talking about Reb Zalman, we could easily fill the hour without any question. So I sort of ended up by deciding to start with his epitaph because I figured that somebody gave a lot of thought to this epitaph, and so this would be a good way to summarize him. So first of all, you see his years here. He died a few years ago. This will be his sixth Yahrzeit coming up. He was born in 1924. He lived a very long life. He died right before his 90th birthday. We were all getting ready to go to a 90th birthday celebration when he died. And this is what it says on his tombstone. This is my translation. It says, the Rav HaTomim. I didn't translate Tomim because that word has so many different meanings, but it means a simple Jew. It means somebody who is... Tom is kind of like simple, but it doesn't mean simple. It means almost like a pure soul. Meshulam Zalman Hiya, son of Reb Shlomo the Kohen and Mrs. Chaya Gittel, Shachter Shalomi, who worked for renewing Judaism and for repairing the world, Tikkun Olam. He loved all living things, and he brought them close to the source of life. And actually, in his talk about Jewish renewal and what is Jewish renewal, he sings a niggun which says that Tamid Echad, always one, always one. And he talks about Yiddishkeit, but he loved life. He loved all the religions. He talks about, right away when he talks about what is Jewish renewal, he talks about the geese. I mean, so Jewish renewal is something that's going to help the geese. He loved us to God, and you can see that in English. He was a chassid, and the word chassidut comes from the word chesed, which means loving kindness. And I grew up not in a Hasidic family, and I would say that the conversion that I went through when I met Reb Zalman was I switched from being a non-chassid to a chassid. And then, like on many tombstones, says, may his soul be bound up in the bond of life. So I started off with his Wikipedia page to try to talk about who he was, but I ended up just brainstorming this list, which is my list of who he was and what he was. So first of all, he was a Rebbe, though he never took that title on for himself, and in his New York Times obituary, it mentioned very clearly that there was no successor to him, that he was empowering his students, both those who had been given rabbinic ordination and those who had not been given rabbinic ordination, to continue his teaching. So when you think about Hasidim, usually you think about there being a Rebbe, and that Rebbe has a different status than the rest of the people in the community. Now, from a non-Hasidic perspective, we look at a rabbi as being somebody who has some degrees, kind of like a PhD, and learned how to be a rabbi, and then they get the credential and they get a certificate. A Rebbe is a little bit different. People would go to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe would have, they saw the Rebbe as having a greater connection with God than they had access to. And there are also stories about Rebbes having miracles and things like this. So when I was growing up, all this notion of Rebbe was something that I didn't subscribe to. I wasn't going to join a cult. I wasn't going to be a member of a group that idolizes their leader to this extent. We considered cults to be dangerous. But over the 23 years, there's no question about the fact that I looked up to Reb Zalman as my Rebbe, and I do view him as one of the giants of the Jewish world of our time. He was a controversial figure, but I have no hesitation to say that he was on the level of all the greats of Jewish history. He came from a family above Hasidim. His rabbinic ordination in 1947 was from Chabad in Brooklyn. He was certainly a teacher. He was a Kohen. His pastoral work was incredible. You don't know, but I'm a survivor of cancer. And when the night before my surgery, he called me up and he sang to me on the phone. He gave me blessings for the surgeons that were going to operate on me. He had great rachmanis for the people in his community, and the some few thousand members of the Jewish renewal community all would tell stories about how he had personally touched their lives. He was a spiritual director. Interestingly enough, he was hired by the Reconstructionist rabbinical group to talk to their rabbis to create a program in spiritual direction, because in the 1980s, or I'm not sure when this happened exactly, but Mordechai Kaplan had left a legacy where the spiritual life of Reconstructionists was at odds with the dogma of Reconstructionism, or at least what they felt they had inherited. Mordechai Kaplan had worked to kind of take spirituality out of it. Reb Zalman was hired to put it back in. He was a healer. He was a renewalist, and this is very important. When he came to America, he decided he was a restorationist. He was an Orthodox rabbi. And he decided that he wanted to transplant European Yiddishkeit to America, or to North America, or to the world, I guess. But then as he started to meet American Jews, in the late 1940s, he began to go through a transformation himself, where he started to recognize that we were living in a time of paradigm shift. We're going to talk about that later. And that therefore, there needed to be a fundamental shift in Jewish practice. And that was what Jewish renewal was about. Somebody want to say something? I hear some noise. He was a chassid. They came up with this term, neo-chassid. I've seen it put in his direction a couple of times. He created Echo Kashrut, I would say, which is the notion that not only do you have the traditional notions of Kashrut, but in addition, you need to take in the ecology into consideration when you consider Kashrut. He wrote a book about halacha, which he called psychohalacha, which I would say means that if you take Mordechai Kaplan's idea about how Yiddishkeit evolves, how the, the community of Jews evolve Yiddishkeit, and you add to it what we've learned from Freud and psychoanalysis, that we can get to an updated understanding about how Jewish law is going to evolve in the future. He was a futurist. He was an avant-garde Jew. I consider him to be the James Joyce of Judaism. For those people who have read James Joyce, he was a Kabbalist. He was a davener. He created something called, davening is the Yiddish term for prayer. I would say his pet project for all of his life was to try to bring the experience of prayer to people in a more basic way. When he had his first job as a Orthodox rabbi in Massachusetts, he was asked to do some of the service in English, and he quickly realized that the translations available at that time did not give people the same experience that you would have when you would pray in Hebrew. And so he started at that time to come up with his own singable English translations. And originally he would pray in Hebrew before he went to shul. So he would be Yotzer for his prayers. And then he would pray in English for the people. But eventually he learned to pray in English. And he has a lot of teachings about why it's okay to pray in English, because the traditional notion is that there's a question about whether you can pray in the vernacular, although we do have many prayer books in Yiddish, which also is not Hebrew, from the 19th century, so there seemed to be a mixed message coming there. He coined the term davenology, which is the science of the inner experience of prayer. He was a transpersonal psychologist. Specifically, I used to view him as my therapist in my couple's relationship vis-a-vis God. I would come to a session with Reb Zalman, and God would be sitting on one chair and I'd be sitting on the other, and Reb Zalman would try to bring us closer together. I once got really angry at him during a Shabbos service because it sounded to me like he was saying things like intermarriage is okay, which at that time I was very much against intermarriage. And so we had a little talk, and he said, I am not Moshe Rabbeinu. He says, I consider myself to be the director of R&D. So I really like that term. Reb Zalman was the director of Judaism's R&D. He was a professor. He had a master's degree from Boston University, and he had a PhD, interestingly enough. His PhD was from Hebrew Union College. So he had connections with Orthodoxy, with JTS. He had connections with Heschel. And then he got a PhD from Hebrew Union College. And the amazing thing when I'd go to Jewish Shul gatherings was the way that he would bring together people from all the denominations. It was really quite amazing to see Orthodox people praying together with Reform people, and everyone seemed to be happy. And there were atheists and secular humanists. He once made a comment that an atheist is closer to a Jewish mystic than the popular believer. And this particularly resonated for me, because for much of my life I was agnostic, but I had strong emotions about the questions of Judaism. He was a historian, an amazing historian. One had the sense that he could actually taste and feel what it was like to be alive 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. He brought that to life. He was a linguist. He was able to prove from the evolution of Hebrew some things about our relationship to scripture. He was an experiential guide. He was always into labs. You would do things in services that would influence your heart experience toward prayer. One, just to give one example, two people would sit opposite each other and read a psalm, and one person would address the other person, the divine in the other person. So the other person was sitting there as God, and you would read looking into the eyes of God and say the words of the psalm. It's an amazing experience. And he created these I-Thou labs. He was a Murshid, which is a Sufi rabbi, if you will. So he was ordained as a Sufi. He was an ecumenist. He was he used to say, I'm a spiritual peeping Tom. I love to see others get it on with God. And he lived that experience. He would go and hang out with people from other faiths and have very, very serious conversations about their experience. He was a Buddhist scholar. He gave a lecture right before he died about the turnings of the wheel in Buddhism, where he talks about how Buddhism moves through Asia over different periods of time. He was certainly a master of meditation. You know, if you tuned into a radio show where he was a guest, you would hear people talk about their experience leaving Judaism a lot of times, going and sitting in an ashram, and he was able to immediately tap into their teachers, what their meditation was like, and then make suggestions for them about how to go deeper into their meditation. He was a partner with people, with members of other religions. He was a student of world religion. He created something called the spiritual eldering movement, From Aging to Saging. When he was in his 60s, he started to write these books, and then that created a whole movement. There's an organization of people who talk about end-of-life work. He wrote a book. There was a book called The December Project, where he was interviewed by a New York Times author when he was in his late 80s, talking about how Judaism doesn't have a map for the times when the body really starts to shut down and how to continue with your spiritual life. He was an entheogenic traveler. I just learned this word recently, but in 1963, he took LSD with Timothy Leary, took him on his first LSD trip. For a number of years, he would take LSD every year before Pesach, and he said that if you're going to take LSD, you need to have a week dedicated to that, three days of preparation, one day to do it, and 3 days to analyze what happened. For pot, he said it was only 3 days, one day of preparation, one day of doing it, and one day of analysis of what happened. So he was very much a user of drugs for enhancing his spiritual life. And he was very public about it. Obviously, what happened in the late 60s when this became taboo, and so I don't know exactly when he stopped. I don't think he was doing it when he was in his 70s and 80s, but I never did these things with him. He was an amazing composer and musician. He created the notion of paradigm, he publicized the notion that we are in a paradigm shift. And in terms of his association, I would say that until he died, he was orthodox, but he was orthodox as one is orthodox in our age. But I like this term reconformadox, and he was also, basically, he respected people's spiritual lives. I never got anything from him which was in the direction of that my way of being Jewish was invalid in any way. So now let's start off talking about me. These are the times when I overlapped with him. I met him first time 1989, and I'm going to go through the different key parts of my connection with Reb Zalman. So first, let me just talk a little bit about myself. As Hannah said, I grew up in a secular Jewish home. My grandparents on my mother's side were kosher butchers, and they were Orthodox. My grandparents on my father's side, I'm not quite sure. I didn't have much connection with them. My father was estranged from his family. My father was not bar mitzvahed, though he was Jewish. My father got a master's degree in Aristotle, and so he was like a philosopher, though he eventually became a data center manager for companies in New York City. But my father was trying to inject in us his worldview, which, as I had said to Sheila, I kind of view him as an Epicurus in a way. So I had this conflict between my father and my mother's side, which were just very mainstream Orthodox kind of people. Now, mainstream Orthodox back when I was growing up, I was born in 1954, and I would say that that Orthodoxy was very different back then than it is now. Since the immigrants came after the Holocaust, I think that that there's a bigger divide between Orthodoxy and Jews like us. My grandparents never put anything into us like there's anything wrong with us, although my mother would make bacon on Sundays sometimes. So there was a divide in my family, which became a crisis for me in a way, because they sent me to an Orthodox cheder. And so by going to Orthodox cheder, I was learning one thing, but I was seeing something else in my life. And I, especially when my siblings and my cousins started to intermarry, this became a bigger crisis for me because I had made a decision. I had this experience with my great-grandfather when I was 4 or 5 years old at Simchas Torah, where I made a pact with God that I was going to be Jewish. I don't know where it came from, but there was something about walking around the synagogue with the apple when I was a little kid, and I never forgot that moment. And I held on to that moment through my whole life. And it meant to me that I wanted to be Jewish. I really identified with Judaism. But at the same time, I was very influenced by the 60s. I became a child, a child of the 60s. I was kind of a repressed hippie. I never let it all hang down. But my feelings were in the direction of the causes. Identified very strongly with them, and I believed that the world had to change, the environment had to get healed, there shouldn't be war, love was the most important thing. So by the time I was bar mitzvahed, I had the sense, although I had ambivalence, but I had the sense that my future was not going to be with Judaism. But then later in my 20s, I tried to be Orthodox, because I was a lost soul. I would say in my 20s, I was very much a lost soul. And then my attempt to be Orthodox failed because I abandoned it. I don't know if it failed, but they were asking me to become more and more observant. And I got to a point where I realized that I was going to have to leave my family and go out on my own to be Orthodox. And I wasn't willing to do that. So at that point, I stopped wearing my yarmulke. I had been wearing it for 6 months. And so about from 26 until I met Reb Zalman, I had this idea that I wanted to just be a universalist, a mystic, somebody who loved art and music and spirituality, but I was not going to be doing it Jewish because Judaism was not aligned with the 60s and its messages. And I was looking for something that was more enlightened than, I guess I would say, that I thought Judaism was. So then there was just this story that I was at my aunt's house in Rosh Hashanah of 1988. And I was really unhappy because there was so much intermarriage. And so at all of our Jewish gatherings, there were non-Jews there, but I didn't say anything to anybody. But then all the non-Jews left, and I kind of scolded my family because I felt they weren't Jewish enough. My uncle said, "Why don't you check out Reconstructionism? You live in Philadelphia, check out Reconstructionism. Maybe you'll be able to find a Jewish community that way." I came back to Philadelphia for 35 years now. I've been taking yoga with a Jewish yoga teacher from Long Island. She lives in Philadelphia. Her name is Joan White. She's a great yoga teacher. And so I went to Joan. I said, "Joan, do you have any students who daven Reconstructionist?" And that's how I met the Pnei Or community, because Reb Zalman was living in Philadelphia. He lived in Philadelphia from 1975 to 1995. And so So they took me. It was Parshat Noach of 1988. I went to Pnei Or, which was just being renamed. Originally, it was called Bnei Or, Sons of Light. They changed it to Pnei Or because the women, I believe the reason was because Bnei is usually translated as sons of light. So they wanted to make it more egalitarian, so they called it Pnei Or, Faces of Light. This was the original name for Aleph, the Alliance for Jewish Renewal, was called Pnei Or. And when I went to that, service on Parshat Noach of 1988, I was blown away. It felt like they were hippies, but they were doing it. It felt like Orthodox. I had never experienced anything like that. Now, Reb Zalman was not there in that first meeting, but one of the people that was there was this woman here named Shefa Gold. And the moment that was so incredible for me, I was very much a hermit, I would say, at that point in my life. I didn't have very many friends. I lived in an apartment, a studio apartment by myself. And I definitely had some strong needs to have community. So at one point, they did this thing where they stood in a circle, and I was standing outside the circle. I was looking at the people, and all of a sudden, Shefa Gold turned around, smiled at me, reached out her hand and invited me to join into the circle. It felt to me like I had died and gone to heaven. She was beautiful. I didn't have a girlfriend at that time. It felt amazing to me. But then for 7 months or so, basically from Parshat Noach until Shavuot, however long that is, I didn't return to Pnei Or because I felt like I had gone into a pure and holy place and I needed to do teshuvah. And every Shabbos that year in 1988 and 1989, I stayed in my apartment alone and excuse me 1 second.
Okay.
I'm getting distracted.
Yeah, okay.
If you want to join. Sorry, my wife had a meeting until 10:30 and she's joining now, but I'm telling her to join on her phone instead. Anyway, I felt like I needed a purification. I felt like this thing that I had experienced was so holy. The next thing I did was I came back on Tikkun Leil Shavuot, and they had a study session. I went to that. And then these friends I met from the yoga class said, why don't you come to the Aleph Kalah? It was at the time it was called the Pnei Or Kalah of 1989. So I went to the 1989 Kalah, and I took a class with Shefa Gold, which taught me about the structure of the prayer book, that there are sections that you're moved through different worlds as you go through different sections. And I took a class with Rabbi Marcia Prager, who actually, together with Reb Zalman, ended up marrying me and Anna. So I made an oath to myself when I took the class with Marcia Prager that if I ever get married, I would have her do my wedding. I had never met a woman rabbi before. And then on Shabbos, and so I made that oath to myself, but my wife wanted Reb Zalman, so she asked for Reb Zalman, so we ended up with two rabbis at our wedding. The Shabbos morning, I went to a service with Arthur and Phyllis, Arthur Waskow and Phyllis Ocean Berman. Arthur Ocean Waskow and Phyllis Ocean Berman. They took the name Ocean when they got married. And that was the first time I ever heard these words, Elokei Sarah, Elokei Rivka, Elokei Rachel, Elokei Leah. And I have to tell you that week was a transformative experience for me. And that was the beginning of me and my connection to Aleph. Echo. And so my first meeting with Reb Zalman, there was a public session in which Reb Zalman would answer any question that anybody had. I had originally tried to sign up for his class. I was not allowed because I didn't. It was reserved for his advanced student, I was told, and they said, if you're not going to take with Reb Zalman, take with Reb Marcia. So I took the class. So I went to that event where you get to ask the questions. And the question I asked him was, Reb Zalman, this Judaism that I see here, the Jewish practice, the things that we're doing, the things that I see, is this something you made up or did you learn it from your teachers? And I was sure he was going to say, I made it up because it works. But his answer was, I learned it from my teachers. And that completely blew my Orthodox education mind. So the next thing that happened was between 1989, Shabbos after the Kalah, sometime in the summer, until 1995, when Reb Zalman left Philadelphia, there was not a week that I didn't go to Pnei Or Philadelphia. There was not a class that was offered that I didn't take. Within the first year, I would say, I started to develop a relationship with Reb Zalman. And eventually, he recognized that I could be useful for him. So the very first project that he gave me was, he said, Rabbi Gila Reisel Raphael has a box of tapes that I gave her years ago. It's been sitting in her closet. Could you go through this box and tell me what's in the tapes? So there were, I don't know how many tapes there were, hundreds perhaps, cassette tapes, and I went through them one by one. And let me tell you, Reb Zalman's tape collection is quite an experience. I'm just now starting to digitize some of them, but I just want to play one little sample from one of the boxes, which was Reb Zalman's audio Siddur. By the way, I should mention that Aleph Canada has a section called Resources where they have some of the things that I'm going to be playing. They sell them. So Rabbi Daniel Siegel, who lives in Hornby Island, was the first rabbi that Reb Zalman gave Semicha to, and he and also Cheryl Gilbert run the Aleph Canada, as far as I know. So this is an audio Siddur. Reb Zalman recorded it, and he does all the tracks, and you're not going to be able to hear it through the Zoom, but one ear is Hebrew, and the other ear is English, which creates a kind of a synesthesia. So they view Hebrew as being right brain and English as being left brain. And Reb Zalman fuses these things together. So when you listen to it, it really hits you deep in the kishkas. So I'm just going to play the opening track of Reb Zalman's audio Siddur.
Into the body, that marvelous instrument on which the soul plays life for God. The body needs to be heard by us. And so as we scan the body from toe up through ankles, knees, thighs, the pelvis, abdominal region, chest, feeling the breath through arms, hands, elbows, shoulders, neck, head. As we come into the body, we realize that its messages want to be heard, otherwise they come in terms of aches and pains. So we open ourselves to that intricate working, and we thank God for it in the formula. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Asher Yatzar Et Adam Befashmahu, Uvaravu Nekavim Nekavim Chalalim Chalim Organs, Garli Veyadua Lifnei Chisei Kevodecha, Sheim Yipateachecha Open Feilo Yisatim. It would be impossible to resist. I worship you, Ata Adonai, living God, healer of all flesh, O Messiah, who sustains our bodies in wondrous ways.
All right, the next section is on breath. We're not going to listen to the whole thing, though you'd probably be very happy to hear the whole thing. All right, so next, I met my wife, Anna, at Pnei Or in 1990, Tu B'Shvat. And so we were engaged to be married in 1991. And Reb Zalman invited me to go with him because I was getting married. We got married in November, and it was summer of 1991, and he invited me to go on what I believe is a historic trip with him to meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Menachem Mendel. I didn't really go much into his Chabad. I did say he was ordained as a Chabad rabbi. He had met Menachem Mendel when Reb Zalman was 16 years old. Menachem Mendel was 38. And they were both in France. And the year was 1941. Reb Zalman had fled from Vienna, where he grew up. And he met Chabad in Belgium. It was the first time that he learned about Chabad. And actually, the answer that he gave me, you know, are you making this stuff up or did you learn it from your teachers? Now that I've studied more about Reb Zalman over the years, I never asked Reb Zalman this, but I would venture to say that he believes that the seed of Jewish renewal, as he set it up, came from Shneur Zalman's writings, the Baal Tanya, the author of Sefer Tanya, the Lubavitcher's Bible, that Shneur Zalman, in trying to reactivate Yiddishkeit for European Jews, was actually planting all the seeds that Reb Zalman then took in a different direction than obviously the Lubavitchers do nowadays. But in any event, I was on this trip with them and with Reb Zalman and his son Yotam. This was in 1991. And we stood on line for 4 hours. And during that time, I spent the whole time with Reb Zalman. He would teach me things. He would sing songs. It was just an amazing, amazing day. When I got back from there, I couldn't stop thinking about that day. And it had a huge impact on me. Years later, I found out that the Lubavitchers had recorded, in the weeks and months that followed that trip, at some point I started writing down my memories for the trip. I certainly didn't go on the trip with a plan to write up what had happened, but the memories, the experience was so powerful to me that I couldn't stop thinking about it, so I wrote down the experience, and eventually when the Lubavitcher Rebbe died, Menachem Mendel died, Reb Zalman published my article, and then later on I found out that they had taken videos of all of the people who went on the who got dollars from the rabbi. So I have here a video. First, you see Reb Zalman standing in front of the Rebbe, and the Rebbe talks to him Yiddish, and he says to him, blessings and success. It's been a long time since I saw you. You are, of course, a Kohen. New, therefore, you'll most likely duchen. You'll bless the people with the priestly blessings. Rosh Hashanah, an entire month of Tishrei, is approaching in 3 weeks. So don't forget to duchen, and I will bless them. And Reb Zalman had said that he was asking for a blessing for himself from Reb Zalman. Reb Zalman was a Kohen. And then he said, may it be in a good hour, good tidings. So this is interesting because in 1968, the Lubavitchers basically said Reb Zalman's ordination as a rabbi was not completely kosher. And they distanced themselves from him because someone had called up the Rebbe and said, did you give permission for Reb Zalman to take LSD? And Reb Zalman had had several conversations with the Rebbe over LSD, but for whatever reason, they got nervous, or maybe it wasn't the Rebbe himself who kicked Reb Zalman out. Maybe it was the machinery of Lubavitch. Anyway, if you could spotlight my video, I'm gonna move my camera to show you the video of Reb Zalman getting the dollar, then me getting the dollar, and then his youngest son Yotam getting the dollar, then me getting the dollar. This is from 1991. Just give me a second here. I need to show myself. Okay. I'm going to make this full screen in a second. Just a second. Whoop. Just bear with me for a sec here. So that was my moment with the Rebbe. Okay. Okay, so then I started, that was when I started my career as a transcriber and editor of Reb Zalman's works. The first project he gave me was something called Renewal, Not Heresy. So there was a how we differ from the Sabbateans. In the 1700s, maybe 1600s, there was a character named Shabbatai Tzvi who had declared himself the Messiah. And this was a big scandal for the Jewish world. And people viewed Jewish renewal as being like Shabbatai Tzvi. So Reb Zalman wanted to talk about that, and then actually that led to his work as in terms of halacha, in terms of redefining, but revitalizing the way that halacha works. But before that, he wanted to deal with the question about whether he was a heretic. So he gave this lecture in 1991 at the Kala, and he asked me to transcribe it. And that first project that I did, I transcribed every grunt that he made. You know, I tried to do it very accurately. Once again, on the Aleph Canada website, you can find this. It's called, it was originally called Renewal is Not Heresy. They renamed it later on to Renewal is Judaism Now. So I transcribed that. I was not an editor at that point. I was just a transcriber.
Seth, I'm going to interrupt for 1 second. We have a question that's just been posted on chat. Please explain the meaning of the exchange of dollars. This goes back to your video. Don't want to lose that momentum.
No problem. So the way that Reb Zalman explained it to me was that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was trying to model the giving of tzedakah, that he gave a dollar to each person because he wanted Jews to give tzedakah. When Reb Zalman came through, you saw him give multiple dollars. So he gave $1 for Reb Zalman. He gave $1 for the people that Reb Zalman was going to duchen for. And you'll have to read my article. So in the announcement for this, there's a list to my website, and you can find a trip to Brooklyn on there, and that will explain the dollars in more detail if you read that article.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. So I transcribed Renewal Is Not Heresy, and this was an amazing experience for me because at that time in my life, and let me just... Sheila, let me just ask, is it okay if I go over about 10 minutes or so? Because I know we have a scheduled stop at 11, but I have a few more things I want to cover, and it's already 10:56.
It's fine, Seth. If people have to leave, then obviously they're free to go, but you can go over for sure.
Okay. So at that time in my life, as I had said, I was pretty troubled. And I had gone to Yale University as an undergrad, and even though I had all of these personal problems, I kind of saw myself as being pretty hot stuff in some way, at least in my own mind. And so the work that Reb Zalman did about Shabbatai Tzvi and the Messiah and the Messiah idea in Judaism, which came out of this lecture, really was had a huge psychological impact on me to deal with my narcissism. You know, I think I was never really a full out narcissist, but I had some narcissistic tendencies. And so one of the things Reb Zalman has said is that the Jungian idea that we all have a dark place in our souls is the place we need to go for our spiritual work, that as we can shine more light on our shortcomings, that's the way that we can grow spiritually. So I'm going to play a little bit of Sheffa Gold singing Dark Rays of the Moon, which there's another pamphlet you can get on the Aleph Canada site called Yom Kippur Katan and the Cycles of Teshuvah. Yom Kippur Katan is a ritual that is done the day before Rosh Chodesh every month. It's a fast day in many months. Some months it's not because of the holidays and things, like you don't do it during Hanukkah. But it's a service, and Reb Zalman lays out there a way of teshuvah. And he talks about his discussion with the psychoanalyst Eric Neumann, in which they talk about the dark rays of the moon, which turned into Sheffa Gold's song, Dark Rays of the Moon.
My flaws are showing all too clear in the dark rays of the moon. All my certainty will disappear in the dark rays of the moon. I surrender to the shadow. Dark rays of the moon. I am strengthened
So the Hebrew refrain is, "Compassionate one who answers broken hearts, answer us, answer us." And the words are, "My flaws are showing all too clear in the dark rays of the moon." So there was this idea that the moon gives off a kind of light, even though it's a dark light. The next project I worked on, Reb Zalman called me up. He taught some classes in the community on Kabbalah. What happened was he discovered a book in the 1970s that was written by a young man who was killed in the Holocaust. This young man had come from a Chabad family. He lived in Warsaw, but because of the political and economic situation, his parents couldn't send him to a Chabad yeshiva, so he studied with the non-Hasidim, they call them the Mitnagdim. He studied at a place called Slobodka, and there he learned that the Vilna Gaon and Shneur Zalman had a rift that happened during their time. The Vilna Gaon was the authority, and Shneur Zalman was a young whippersnapper at that time. And so they had some disagreements about Kabbalah. And this 23-year-old wrote a book in which he brings harmony between the Vilna Gaon and Shneur Zalman. But also, it's a very nice introduction to Kabbalah. So Reb Zalman was offering these classes in Germantown, and Ann and I went to them. That was the year that my first daughter was born, so I was probably going more than Anna was going. But in any event, we went to these classes, and then he taught it at Alat Chaim, which was to his more advanced students. And then he called me up on December 26, 1994. And the reason I remember that date was because I was going to be turning 40 the next day. And I don't know if you've heard about the teaching that says you shouldn't study Kabbalah until you're 40 years old, you have a job, you're married, you have children. So I met all of those qualifications, and I had avoided Jewish mysticism up to that point in my life, just like I had avoided LSD. I avoided things because I felt I was too fragile. But I decided that I would take on a project Reb Zalman had suggested, which was to transcribe and organize his lectures on Kabbalah. So I worked on that from 1995 to 1997. I sent it to him. I sent the manuscript to him on Tu B'Shvat 1997. It wasn't finally published, I believe, until like 2011. So there was 14 years between the time I finished my work and the main editor of the book published it. And you can also get this on the Aleph Canada website. It's called A Key to the Wisdom of Faith is the name of that particular book. And then just a quick lesson on Kabbalah here. So the divine name, which is shown here in this human form with the yud above the hay, above the vav, above the hay, that this name is associated with the four worlds, Atzilut, Berea, Yetzira, and Asiya. And all of these come from the light of Ein Sof, which is beyond the beyond, that the light comes through and the vessels reflect them. And then below is our experience of the world, Klipat Noga, which is the place where we experience all of the confusion and irrationality and randomness that we experience. And then we have choices where we can either move toward the light or we can move away from the light. And so this is a chart I put together for a class that I teach, where we were studying the Sefer Tanya. Shneur Zalman uses a lot of these terminologies, so I put this chart together for that class. I had my cancer in 2003, and as I was coming off my cancer in 2004 and my chemo and that whole year, which was very challenging, I asked Reb Zalman for another project, and he had given a lecture on halacha, and I knew that halacha in a way is the most fundamental way to understand the differences between different groups. So he gave his psychohalacha lecture in 1993. Interestingly enough, that was the weekend that my daughter was born. My older daughter Rebecca was born that weekend, and Reb Zalman was in Philadelphia because he was recovering from surgery. But at the Kala that year, which was in Berkeley, California, Reb Zalman delivered his lecture by video, and I had never seen this thing transcribed or published. So I asked Reb Zalman, could I transcribe it? I ended up teaming up with Reb Daniel of Hornby Island. At that time, he lived in Massachusetts, and we worked together on that project. It's a book that's called Integral Halacha, and it was renamed from Psychohalacha to Integral Halacha, but that's available on Amazon. And I was doing all this work for Reb Zalman, and I said, Reb Zalman, I want a Jewish credential because I'm doing all this work. I'm worried that my daughters are going to grow up. I'm going to do all this work, and I want them to be Jewish. So he said, you know what? I'm going to make you a gabbai. So he gave me this gabbai semicha, which basically says, in truth, it is hereby declared to whomever inquires for this information that for many years, her teacher, Reb Shmuel Ruvain Fishman, may he live for good and lengthy days, has studied God's perfect Torah in order to achieve his purpose to become one who helps establish the Shekhinah of our strength through attending to matters of the needs of the faith community, and he serves me faithfully. So that's a part of what it says. So when I publish my book, I'm going to put this in the front because I'm not a rabbi, I'm not a PhD, and people need to understand I got some kind of credential. From 2004 until 2014, every year Reb Zalman would come to Elat Chaim on Shavuot, and so we got a lot of chance to hang out at that time. He was living in Boulder, Colorado. From 1995, he moved to Boulder, Colorado, to take the position of World Wisdom Chair at Naropa University. But I got to see him at Shavuot, and I would work as his gabbai there, which means that anybody who wanted to see Reb Zalman, I would make a list of people, and he would decide who he was going to see. So I kind of organized the people that got to see him, which was an interesting process. And during that time, that was when he invited me to be the webmaster for his blog, Reb Zalman's blog, which the Jewish Renewal Hasidus website is the place which started out as the Legacy Project. So originally it was called RebZalmanLegacy.org. In 2011, the archives of the Reb Zalman archives moved from Naropa University to the University of Colorado. At that time, they said they didn't need a blog, Reb Zalman's blog. So at that time, I renamed it to Jewish Renewal Hasidus. So you will find there a lot of Reb Zalman's teachings during the last 10 years of his life. And so I just want to quickly show the website. And there's something there. I said, oh, Davener Adieu. So this is the website. This is what it looks like. And there are two articles in particular I want to bring your attention to. One of them is called Hilula, Reb Zalman's Hilula, which is the account of Reb Zalman's funeral, which is amazing, really worth reading. Obviously, a trip to Brooklyn, I had mentioned previously. You can read that there. And then also, O Davener Adieu, which was the very last public lecture Reb Zalman gave before he went into a coma. It was at Shavuot in 2014, and I transcribed it here. He went into a coma the next day. He revived in Hartford, Connecticut, and they medevaced him to Boulder, Colorado. Somebody donated $25,000. He seemed to be recovering, and then he died on July 3rd in 2014 at home. So anyway, that's the website, which I worked on a lot in the last 10 years. And then finally,
Seth, we didn't see the website. You didn't show us the website or give us the link. Can you do that?
I am so sorry. I didn't realize I didn't share it. Yeah, let me just go back and share it.
We'd like to see that. Thank you.
Okay, here we go. Share screen. So the URL is jewishrenewalhasidus.org, or for short, it's jhasidus.org. jhasidus, spelled like this, without a C, single S, .org. jewishrenewalhasidus.org. And when you come into the main page, there is a search function. And so I'm saying you could put in here a trip to Brooklyn. You can put in here Hilula to read about his funeral. And then you can put in here about Adieu to read his last lecture. But there's much more there. So in 2008, just a quick story, and then I'll wrap it up for questions. In 2008, Reb Zalman, let me share again my presentation, just a second. In 2008, Reb Zalman would send me stuff before the holidays related to things that he wanted to tell the community. And so he would send me, usually they were in English, but in 2008, he said, I'm going to be sending you something for Purim. And he sent me some articles in Hebrew. And I had never translated Reb Zalman's Hebrew. And I didn't want to ask him, do you want me to try to translate it? You know, I didn't want to bother him. Like I said, I didn't bother him. So I remember just schwitzing this question, should I try to translate Reb Zalman from Hebrew to English? And I put it out there. Now, when I go back and I look at some of my early translations, I cringe a little bit at this point. But basically, I've been translating Reb Zalman now for 12 or 13 years. And this is the area, the last part of my life that I've really been focusing on. And there's a book called Yishmerudat, which some of the people on this call study with me every week. In Philadelphia, if anybody would like to join that group, please let me know. We meet every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. on Zoom now because of this. Well, we always meet on Zoom because the previous rabbi of my synagogue joins from Maryland. So we're always on Zoom, whether we're in person or not. And so I hope in the next year to publish a book on paradigm shift related to Reb Zalman's teachings on paradigm shift. And I just, for the last slide, I just want to share this chart that I put together talking about the different ages. So just quickly to summarize, Reb Zalman would say that Judaism is moving into the age of Aquarius, which is going to be, I mean, God willing, we all survive. The human species survives. Yiddishkeit survives for the next 2,000 years. Of course, that's not a given. But if that happens, then Judaism is not going to be, there are going to be major changes in Judaism that will be occurring in the next 2,000 years, and that's what this book is going to be about. So that's all that I've prepared for today. I can leave this chart up for a little bit if you want to digest it a little bit, but otherwise I'm going to turn it back over to Naomi for any Q&A or comments.
There is a question that's come to us over chat. It said, I had to miss part of your talk. Did you talk about his visit with the Dalai Lama?
I did not talk about his visit with the Dalai Lama in the 1960s. Well, when the Tibetans went into exile in the 1950s, Reb Zalman was already aware and in touch with people from that community, and he contacted them in the 1960s. I believe it was 1963, and he said, "I would like to discuss to meet with His Holiness to talk about lessons that Jews have learned about how to preserve our tradition in exile." And that meeting didn't happen until 1990. It is documented in the book called The Jew in the Lotus. Actually, it's that which is a pun, because the Tibetans' mantra is the jewel, in Sanskrit, I believe, is the jewel in the lotus. This is their core mantra. And they named the book The Jew in the Lotus because when they got to Dharamsala to meet with the Dalai Lama, they found out that there were a lot of American Jews there that were serving as the right-hand people, as the lamas, to the Dalai Lama. There was a Harvard PhD in particular, and so who was the Dalai Lama's right-hand man. And then when they did a Kabbalat Shabbat service, Roger Kamenetz, who wrote the book, noticed that the Jews and the Buddhist Jews were all davening together, and he was wondering whether God was kind of with a tennis racket was hitting the prayers of the Tibetans into another pile, of the American Jews into another pile, because they weren't strictly Jewish. So it really highlighted some of the questions about how we can grow in spiritual ways and avodah zarah. When is our practice going to really be a sin, or when is it going to be making Yiddishkeit stronger? So that's a great book also that you can read, The Jew in the Lotus, if you're not familiar with it.
Another question via chat, Seth. Could you speak briefly about the paradigm shift?
Yes, briefly. There's this notion that the Torah is immutable. We say, the chant that we sing at the end of Friday night service, I can't remember what it's called. Say it again, Judith.
Yigdal.
Yigdal, Elohim Chai. So they say that the Torah is immutable. It's never going to change for all generations. And in Deuteronomy, it says that Ani Havai Ani Hashem Lo Shaniti, I don't change. But then there's this notion that in every generation there's a change. So the question is, the Torah, and also that the Torah speaks in the language of human beings, which means that the Torah has to make sense to our seichel, and halacha has to make sense to our seichel. So this is a very big, complicated area, because the Reform movement would tell you that the halacha has to align with our seichel, so therefore we're not going to keep kosher. But Reb Zalman did it from an Orthodox perspective. He came in and he said, yes, even within the Jewish mainstream, even within the observant Jews, there is a paradigm shift that happened. And the basic example he gives was when the Second Temple was destroyed, Yochanan ben Zakkai at that time, who was the leader of the generation, decided that we weren't going to go back for Bayit Shlishi. Now, some people would say, well, he couldn't, they would have been killed. But even to this day, there's a question about Bayit Shlishi should have animal sacrifice, even within the Orthodox community. So that was a paradigm shift. When we started lighting candles on Shabbos, that was a paradigm shift, because before then, there were no fires in our possession, in our habitations. They said that you couldn't have a fire in your habitation. The rabbi said, there will be a time when there won't be a temple and you can't go to the priest. And then you have to go to the authority at that time and they'll tell you what to do. We're the authority. We tell you to light candles. So paradigm shift has been going on throughout Jewish history. And it has to do with a question about how connected are you to Torah? How connected are you to the things in your time? And what are the new practices? An example of a new practice is that if you want to be eco-kosher, you can't use recycled bottles. But if you want to save the planet, you have to use recycled bottles. So there's a conflict between saving the planet. If the planet dies, if we become extinct, then what's the good of halacha as we've inherited it?
Okay, I'll invite anybody who has a question to unmute themselves. Norma?
It's Norma. Yeah, I did raise my hand. Hi, Seth. Two things. When is the yahrzeit for Reb Zalman that you said? What was the date?
It's next, a week from Friday, a week from this Friday. It's the
What day is that? Do you know?
A week from Friday night. It is the 5th of the month of Tammuz. The 5th day of the month of Tammuz. And if you ever forget it, it happens to be the date of Ezekiel's vision of the chariots.
Reb Zalman married my husband and me as part of a Sufi ceremony along with Pir Vilayet Khan and others. And it's almost our anniversary, and it sounds like this yahrzeit is on the same day. I just have to look it up. We're very close.
Okay, I don't have the date in front of me.
Part of a week-long retreat.
Well, you know, the Hebrew yahrzeit moves every year, so it's not the same date every year.
No, I know that.
And his English,
but it just does sort of happen to come this year. It's always nice if it comes on a year.
Absolutely,
when
absolutely. Congratulations.
Too.
How many years is it?
43.
Okay, mazel tov.
I had one other question, and I'm blanking on it right now.
Well, hold on to it for a minute. Yeah. Shayla has a question.
I have more a comment. I knew Rabbi, in those days he was Rabbi Shaster to me, in Winnipeg at Hillel. I was very active at Hillel in the 1960s, and as a result, we used to go to his house for Shabbat, and he used to make us tea, but in the tea he put gel, you know, the jello that you get that has the, that you make jello out of it for kids? He used to put jello in the tea. I don't know if he still did that, but he used to make jello in the tea. And there weren't a lot of people in Hillel, but not a huge number compared to the number of Jewish students. But we had a pretty active group, and of course he was the leader. And he also married me. He and the rabbi from my synagogue also married me. So then I left Winnipeg, and then he left Winnipeg.
Wow, fantastic! Were you interviewed by the Legacy Project? They interviewed people about his years in Winnipeg.
Nope.
Okay, well, maybe I'll get your contact information if it's okay and talk to you about that. I'd love to hear more.
Sure, because I didn't know him that well, but we always went to his house on Friday nights.
Okay.
And we always had this tea.
Fantastic.
Shayla, do I have your permission to send your email to Seth?
Sure.
Okay, I'll do that. Joel, you had a question? Or
I have a comment, kind of a question. I have a good friend, I won't share his name right now, from Winnipeg, who was in Rabbi Schachter's classes on Jewish mysticism, and in the class they would take drugs together, or they had assignments that involved taking drugs and then writing assignments and what they experienced and how it affected them spiritually.
Wow.
I could ask him about sharing his contact if you'd want that. Like,
Sure. I'd love to.
The only drug I ever saw was tea and with jello in it. That was our big one.
My other memory, in the early 1990s, we would go every year for Pesach to our family in Toronto, and I'm one of the leaders of Das Shalom, a shul without a rabbi that's been influenced by Jewish renewal. And I heard one year that Reb Zalman was going to be leading davening at this minyan in Toronto. So I said to my dad, "Let's go." And Reb Zalman was there with his son Shalom Schachter, who was one of the leaders of this. I forget what it was called, the Kehillah or something. And in the minyan, he was experimenting. He said he was going to try something new. And he was talking about this bilingual davening. So he took some psalm and he said, "I'm going to say it in Hebrew, and my son Shalom is going to, together, we're going to do it in English." So they did a few prayers like this. He was experimenting, and he wanted us all to experience that, and my dad and me did. Then he saw my dad and me together, and he said, "Shneem halchu yachad." which of course is the reference to Abraham and Yitzchak on their way to the Akedah. You have that twice. I saw it. There was really a warmth and a personal charisma in a quiet way, certainly. And nice to see you again. Is Jewish renewal continuing to thrive after his death? It seems it is to me, but any thoughts?
I was always outside of the organization. I latched onto Reb Zalman. When he left Philadelphia, I left Pnei Or. And so I can't really tell you what's happening with Jewish renewal. I can tell you, though, that I am working very hard to continue with his legacy. And I hope to be a part of the future of the Reb Zalman legacy. My own sense, I went to the Aleph Kala in 2016. I went in 2013. My sense was that they've forgotten him to some degree. That if anything, the people who are running the Kalot now say, we need to move on from Reb Zalman. He was great, and the people that knew him loved him, but his students didn't do a great job to inflame people the way that he did. So the movement it's become like a denomination, whereas originally it was a vision that was perpendicular to denominations. So it does. He said that he likes it that way. There's a video out there which you can find called "What Is Jewish Renewal," in which he talks about Jewish renewal as a denomination and not as a denomination, and that if you look at it as a denomination, he likes it because it's quality control. If you come to Oshkosh and you find there's a Jewish renewal service, you're going to know they're going to be doing chanting, they're going to be doing a lot of stuff in English, they're going to make you feel friendly. So he liked the idea that there were both kinds. He was not trying to grow the Jewish renewal denomination. I would say that was not his main focus. And that's not my interest either. I'm more interested through my Orthodox cheder lens to continue to make the message that it is perpendicular to a denomination.
Can you share your email and your blog? Sheila, through Sheila somehow.
Sure, Sheila, you can
get in touch with Seth. Follow up.
Seth, if you send me the website and give me permission to share them with the participants in this program, I'd be happy to do that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so I'll send that to you when I receive it from Seth. Someone had a question. Well, Norma remembers, I guess, her second comment.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that I think that, at least, and I may be wrong, but I feel very much that Reb Zalman's legacy is in the Reconstructionist movement because, you know, in my life, I never could really, I didn't really go become a Jew again until I was in my 40s, like 30-some years ago, when I discovered Reconstructionism, because right now, admittedly, I was out of the box already because I was a Sufi and I was involved, and I've been a Quaker for 44 years, and I've been a Sufi for 46 years, and then I came to Judaism about 30 years ago, back home, as it were. But I can't give up the others, so I do them all together, and
I think that's not so outlandish to say that renewal and Reconstructionism are aligned. I think that Reb Zalman took the principles of Mordechai Kaplan and he applied them in a different way because he was more focused on the spiritual connection to God, and so he wanted to use that as the basis for the reconstructing of Judaism. So
right.
So they're not that different.
And we have another question for you, Seth. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. You're on screen. It says Hashavua, so
no,
I don't think
Abigail.
That's your name. But
yeah, Abigail Hirsch.
Oh, Abigail. Okay.
Oh, Abigail. How are you? I know you.
So Joel told me about this because Joel and I had gone to one of the kalot together, and that's how we met. And I wanted to share my own experience with Zalman which goes back a very long time when I was living in New York, and my friend Judy Brott and I discovered Zalman, and we started going to the Pnei Or meetings in Philadelphia, and we used to attend his, for every holiday, he would rent this retreat place in the Poconos, and bring a vegetarian chef.
Fellowship Farm, right?
The whole holiday from Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchas Torah, all on the premises with all
wow.
the students. It was amazing. Mind-blowing. And I share this with you. Well, I'm not exactly, but I grew up in an Orthodox family where I couldn't really identify with the Orthodoxy. And I had been to Israel, and, you know, and when I met Zalman, it brought me back to Judaism. It brought me back to Yiddishkeit in a whole different way, which, you know, it's with me to this day. And I'm just so grateful for Zalman, you know, and what he gave me. And I just want to share, well, you know, that was so long ago. I was in my teens. I was in my 20s, actually. But that recent, he has a student, Judy Brott. I don't know if you, Seth, you probably know her. Judy Brott?
I don't know the name. How do you spell it?
B-R-O-D-T. Anyway, she married a student of Zalman's from Montreal, and they made Aliyah, and they have a yeshiva in Jerusalem. And I've been studying. A year ago, they started a yeshiva for women called Shiviti, and now I'm studying with scholars, with female scholars from Jerusalem, who are actually Breslov Hasidim, you know, they're all Orthodox, but I'm able to connect with them because of Zalman. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. It was called Fellowship Farm, right? The place in the Poconos?
Yes, it was called Fellowship Farm. Yes, absolutely. Fellowship Farm.
So yes, Seth, Joel, go ahead, and then we will conclude.
I just wanted again to thank Seth for excellent presentation. Something that's happening in Ottawa and across Canada that people may be interested in and may not know about. Lauren, Shefa Gold kind of created a modernized Hebrew chant and has been teaching people across Canada. One of her trainees, Lauren Mallon, was in Vancouver at Or Shalom, a Jewish renewal school, started chanting in chocolate. He was in Ottawa for a year and a half, and I helped him, others helped him, and it's now continuing every week, actually, cross-country on Zoom, chanting in chocolate every Sunday at 7 or 7:30, and it's now hosted at the Ottawa Reconstructionist School. I can, if you look at chanting in chocolate, search on Google, you'll find it. So every Sunday, you can join chanting. So I think Zalman is
chanting in chocolate.
Chanting and search for chanting in chocolate. It's hosted in Ottawa, but they also have it in Montreal, some in Vancouver. It's a Hebrew chant. So Zalman somehow was an enabler to all kinds of people to try new things. And I think Shefa spawned this chanting, and she's teaching it, and there's hundreds of trained people, and Lauren is just one of them. And I think it's enriching and diversifying the type of prayer and worship. So look at chanting and chocolate if you're interested.
Thank you, because I'm also studying chanting, have been with Dave Goldstein from Pittsburgh, PA, who was Shefa's student. But he hasn't really refined his online. He would come here to Philly. I would invite him to come and do a chant workshop with us every couple years. So this is good to know there's a chant stuff on.
It's right now, it's every Sunday at 7:30.
Well,
I think chocolate is a very good place to end. Thanks, Joel. Seth, on behalf of AJA 50 Plus, and I'm going to speak for Hannah, who's still muted, but your family, thank you very much for doing this for us. We really appreciate it. We had a very substantial audience this morning, which is always nice to see. Sometimes 10 in the morning, you don't know what you're going to get, because, of course, 10 a.m. and 4 a.m. and 6 p.m. are all the same right now. So thank you very much. It was nice to meet you and the other people who are your associates.
I just want to point out my wife is Anna Kitsis. Her face keeps coming in and going. There she is.
Yeah, she looks like she's walking. Are you having a stroll, Anna?
Okay. The house, but I have a question about paradigm shift, if I could ask the speaker if he knows about paradigm shift and sharing of equal responsibilities in the Jewish household.
I'm gonna let the two of you duke that one out. Though
Anna and Seth are in my
room. Gonna say, Anna, whatever your position is, I support that.
Okay, good answer.
So
that's
again,
our rabbi here in Philly and north of Philly. He's in my shul. I'm in his shul and Anna's shul.
Right. So thank you, Seth. Thank you, Anna, for letting us have him. Or maybe you should thank us for having him for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I'm glad that my daughter is right now at McGill, and she's going to be graduating this week.
Mazel tov. Whatever that means these days,
Canadian
with graduation.
Connection.
Canadian connection.
Oh. Anna, you're Hannah's cousin, right? I met you at the Kala.
We did meet, yes.
Right.
Outside at the Kala, right.
I think in that family, Joel, everybody's names have to rhyme.
Hannah and I are named after our grandmother.
Ah.
All right, well,
nice
thanks again,
you.
Seth, if
I
you want
to. Say something to Seth, Marcia and I met Reb Goldie in Sarasota and took a couple of courses with her.
Nice.
By the way, I'm in Montreal. If you come up here, please contact me.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you for your story. It was very beautiful.
You're welcome. Oh, thank
you.
Yes.
Your email with Sheila.
Yeah,
Sheila,
so. I will send that off when I have Seth's email, but I don't have the website or the URL, so just send that to me and I'll send it off.
The website was in the announcement for this class. In your book.
Oh, yeah, but you know what?
All right, I'll send it.
2 weeks ago. That's a whole other world.
I'll send it. No problem.
All right. Thanks again, everybody. I hope to see many of you in our upcoming programs. And any of you who are not our members, if you're interested in our programming, which for the duration of the summer is free of charge, just send me an email and I can send you the various programs that we have coming up. So thanks again, Seth. Thanks again, Anna, and all of the other people.
Bye.
Abigail, I grew up in Montreal, but that's a whole other program we could have, playing Jewish Montreal geography.
Sure.
And there's a fellow named Lou whose face is frozen on our screen, but just so you know, Seth, he is there. I had to send him the link during your talk, but he seems, oh, there he is in the flesh now. So thank you, everybody, again, and we hope to see many of you in the very near future. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.